This podcast is produced by the St. Louis Psychoanalytic Institute, educating professionals and helping people of all ages and circumstances to understand their lives. Visit us at stlpi.org to learn more.
I'm going to start with a little bit of a confession. When I was first asked to do a film for the Celluloid Couch series, I thought, that sounds fantastic, and I just said yes, and I was going to figure out which film to do. And psychoanalytic theory is often used for some of the movies that have really complicated, dark characters. And it can be remarkably helpful at helping us understand things that are beyond our imagination. And then I thought, but whatever film I choose, I'm going to probably watch it about 10 times. So I had all these things in mind, Winter's Bone and some of these really dark gray things. I thought, no. Let me please try a comedy. So with that little bit of thought in mind, I just want you to be thinking here, as our world changes so much, and who is defined as family seems to keep changing. In this movie, we could easily go about 40,000 different directions and things to discuss analytically. But my comments later, which will last roughly 15 minutes or so, will be something along this line in a very broad stroke about how we look at family, who we accept as family, what do genetics mean or not. So one little caveat, if you have not seen the film, just to be forewarned, there is some colorful language and some sex. If you have trouble with that, you're forewarned. Otherwise, enjoy, and I'll be right back. I think psychoanalytic work can shed light that we wouldn't necessarily come across otherwise. One question will certainly be raised, so I'm going to address it immediately. Does Laser, as a boy, need or crave a male role model? It is his request that starts the real story of the movie. His buddy Clay has a father at home who seems less than fantastic and doesn't seem to be having such a positive effect on Clay. But the question has also been asked more broadly of children in any non-traditional family. Of course, for millennia, there have been children without known fathers, genetic fathers who have no idea that their genes have been passed down, parents off at a war or a distant job, and plenty of children, adopted or otherwise, who have grown up with someone they called dad or mom, with whom they have no genetic relationship whatsoever. Psychoanalysts who have worked for decades with families who've used assisted reproductive technology and other non-traditional families note that there is always some curiosity and fantasy about the other, be that sperm or egg donor, surrogate mother, by the children and by the parents. But curiosity about the other is completely normal. We have to be careful not to infer a massive lack. In fact, a key point here is that fantasies about the other abound throughout life for all of us. When we're kids, no matter what our family constellation, we fantasize about the parent we don't have or the sibling we wish we had. Later, we fantasize about the dating relationships we want, and then later in life, the perfect lover, etc., etc. And we learn throughout life that we get to take people in packages and that there will always be qualities of the other that we wish we had. So it can be a huge mistake to interpret curiosity as necessarily indicating something distinctly wrong, although sometimes that happens too, not to say that it does not. Clinically, I've worked with a few people over the years who were adopted into stable, heterosexual, mainstream, intact families, people who grew up not being able to look at either parent and say, that's where I got my nose, or those are my eyes, or we share this talent, or that's my temperament. Whether those people want to meet either birth parent or are adamantly opposed, there is always some idea about who those other people are and who we wish they would be to us. Therapeutically, if Laser were in therapy, we would want to know the specifics of his ideas or his questions. the pictures of what he wants or fears, what we analysts would call his fantasies, but none of those really turn up here in the movie. What Laser does say is that he didn't have any specific questions, and he initially felt that Paul was a little into himself. We could wonder whether that indicates that he'd imagined a sperm donor who would share more of his own interests, like maybe basketball, and hope to know him better, but as it's presented here, we just simply don't know. Joni's response to their first meeting is that she hadn't expected him to be cool or interesting, and that's all we really know about her thoughts. And then there are the things that don't happen here. Neither Joni nor Laser start calling him Dad. They're curious, and they want to know more about him. Sometimes they seem to like him, but they don't seem rushing to make him part of the family. During the dinner at Paul's house, Paul is the one who makes the toast to the unconventional family. Nobody else chimes in to second him. Fantasies can also help us look at another of Laser's questions. Why do you guys watch gay man porn? All of this sex in the movie about a lesbian couple somehow involves men. Chola Danko, who co-wrote and directed the film and is a lesbian, says that everybody has their thing and notes that there are lesbians who will sometimes look at gay man porn as part of their sex life. And someone will undoubtedly ask about Jules. Well, which is she, gay or straight? Gay man porn? Why not lesbian or perhaps heterosexual? Gay man porn doesn't initially make sense, again, if we're looking at the surface. But a major point here to understand about fantasies, whether it's about sperm donors or sexual fantasies, is that we have to be cautious to not get terribly concrete about them. Just like Laser's fantasies regarding his sperm donor, we can get ourselves into major trouble if we assume too much from curiosity or even wishes. Let me take a very obvious example here. Rape fantasy is a very common sex fantasy, but I have yet to meet anyone who wants to actually get raped. So why then would it be such a very common fantasy? There will be some element that is important, say, the wish to be so desirable that another person simply cannot help themselves. So that's a far cry from wanting an actual rape, but the emotional element of it is important. I've heard of more than a couple of situations where a well-meaning lover was trying to give the gift of enacting some sexual fantasy, only to find that the enactment would have been better left alone. What little Jules tells us about their sexual desires and needs is in the form of her response to Laser's question about women's sexuality being internalized. So far as that explanation goes, doesn't go very far. It's striking that in all the affair scenes with Paul, she doesn't do anything I would call romantic. When Nick asks about the affair later, she says that she needed to be appreciated. But there's little here that convinces me that the affair is about her being appreciated. Jules' need for intensity does seem remarkable. She wants Paul to pull her hair. She slaps him. I wonder if he was a little surprised by this. Perhaps what she is getting from Paul is that intensity. It's a new lover. It's certainly forbidden. It feels crazy to her, and she's asking him for things that can be at least minimally painful. Does that make it all penis-focused? No. Just like looking at any kind of fantasy, we have to be careful here about assuming too much from an outside picture. That's clear in the mental health field, where increasingly we're understanding that sexuality, for women especially, can be quite fluid. This seems to be more true for a significant number of women and not necessarily for as many men. Nonetheless, we're still somehow more comfortable with gay or lesbian than we are the title bisexual. However Jules would describe it, and I don't know whether she would describe herself that way or not, her response to Paul's emotional overtures is clear. When he says that he thinks he's falling for her, she just kind of rolls her eyes and says, "Oh, don't." And when he says, "Let's just do this thing," you can see her impatience. She retorts that she's gay and she hangs up and actually throws the phone away. Her attachment to Nick, however convoluted and complicated, does seem far more important to her than any attachment to Paul. And attachments here are big. Attachment theories have been important in psychoanalytic theory for decades, and increasingly infant research is showing us that, independent of family constellation, what is important is connection. We can sadly think of all sorts of families where it seems that there's not a very secure attachment between the parents and the kids. When children have had secure attachments with at least one caretaker, they tend to grow to be adults who can have trusting, lasting relationships, and they're comfortable with intimacy and autonomy. Pretty good way to raise a kid. There is no family structure that guarantees a good attachment, and there is no family structure that necessarily precludes a good connection. Do kids absolutely have to have a father? Do kids absolutely have to have a mother? What we see time and again is that kids need people. They need attachments. They need at least one adult who is consistent, safe, loving, and attentive, and connected. Think of the joy of seeing someone who brightens when they notice you, when you know that he or she is happy to see you. That's a good connection. There's plenty of evidence of good enough attachments here with both Joni and Laser. Each is navigating adolescence with the typical questions of defining themselves, making choices about friends, who works and who doesn't, and they even seem to be reasonably good friends with one another. They can have discussions about difficult subjects with their moms, and they are considerate of moms' feelings. At these ages, they are supposed to be separating from their moms, but they can also be connected with them. Their capacities to grow as individuals and make good choices about their friendships and relationships is indicative of good attachments. We can see that Jules has been primarily the stay-at-home mom, so she's been around more physically, but her personality is also more focused on the emotional world, so the kid's attachment with her has a comfort that's fairly easy. Nick seems to regard parenting as shaping behavior, so her reaching the kids is a bit more complicated. The one connection in the film that seems most hurting is the marriage. The lack there is like a hungry belly that's constantly growling. We've all watched marriages age and become stale, where the nagging and dissatisfactions trump the earlier joys of togetherness, where monogamous sex is less than enticing and invigorating. Nick and Jules here look like a typical suburban couple with the kinds of problems almost expected for a marriage of 20 years with the first kid soon leaving for college. We might even be impressed that the couple can still check in with one another on parenting issues, which they do several times, and discuss how to handle them together. The relationship therapists would tell us that these two could learn a couple of things about how to get along better, how they could structure their interactions that could help them enormously, like using I statements, which they don't do at all. But in the meantime, they plod along, and their distinctive personality styles really jump out at us. When the film opens, everyone's irritated with Nick's demands, her strictness and her micromanaging. She sets limits. Time and again, she sets limits. We wonder why she doesn't lay off, why she doesn't get that it's fiercely irritating and driving people away. Except that it also serves her well in a different flavor. She's a physician and one who's gone to good schools. All that drive and following rules have got her where she is. And in all honesty, I want my physician to be a little bit rigid, paying attention to how things should be done and checking off all the details. Except when she gets home, she needs to be something different. Toward the end of the movie, when we see a family who's become more disenchanted with Paul's inclusion or intrusion, it is Nick who literally closes the door, this time with no family members rolling their eyes. At this point, her ability to set limits is more obviously about her connections, even if she's not thanked for them. And that lack of thanks seems part of what sets Nick on edge. One gets the impression that her family's interest in this feckless sperm donor seems unthinkable to her, even though several times she tries to adjust and overcompensate for the purpose of being connected with the other three in the family. Her intentions are very good. We also see that Nick is capable of connecting with Jules, at least sometimes. She initiates conversations with Jules as co-parent in a sharing way, talking about her own emotional responses and trying to be responsible to the kids' emotional needs as well as getting them to act right. And in the first backyard picnic meeting with Paul, the two appear quite lovingly connected as they share their story about meeting each other in the ER. So while Nick is complicated and often irritating, and her connections are not always easy, she does seem salvageable. Jules is the emotional mom who can stay on track with the feeling parts of their kids. More into life, nature, love, her structure is far more lackadaisical, like her idea for the garden to be more is more. Let's not try to tame the space. Let's let it be lush, overgrown, fecund. Her attentiveness to the feeling world helps keep her on track with difficult conversations with the kids, where she can redirect Nick to the discussion that the kids want and need to have. But there are times that her go-with-the-feelings approach costs her. Obviously, that's part of what happens with Paul. And her tearful apology to the family toward the end says that she has seen what we have been watching, that sometimes you're together so long, you just stop seeing the other person. You just see weird projections of your own junk. And instead of talking to each other, you go off the rails and act grubby and make stupid choices. I do wonder here whether the attraction to Paul is that very laid-back, trying to connect with the other kind of approach that he can bring to conversations. The times that she does respond to him are typically when we might imagine that she is feeling that he sees her, when he invites her to landscape his backyard, when he remarks that he thinks she's talented, and in all honesty, he hasn't seen any of her work yet. We don't have any other verification of exactly what it is that she needs so much that she has the affair. And we would certainly wish that she'd somehow more directly tried to register her need with Nick before there was this disruption. In the end, the kids are all right. Joni and Laser have enough strong attachments to their moms to be satisfied with their family as it is, and to have a good start to their own adult lives. These two kids have loving parents, and they have learned that severe disruptions can be overcome. The family will go through the typical changes as Joni leaves for college, but Nick, Jules, Laser, and Joni basically want the family unit to be that, a family. Joni keeps Paul in some distant sense by taking his hat to college. But we have the feeling that if Paul is going to be around in the future, it probably won't be for a while, and it won't be as part of the family. He is sperm donor, not dad. Perhaps the hopeful part here is that, at the end, Jules is in the driver's seat, we hope taking a bit more responsibility for herself and her part in the family. And we hear from Laser that he thinks they should not break up because they're too old. Tellingly, the last shot is of Laser smiling when he sees his moms holding hands. And the screenplay notes that this small gesture is what he needed to know that they would be okay. Thank you.